Today we're talking with the Director of Golf at St Andrews Links Trust in Scotland, of course the home of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, and as we know, the home of golf. So good morning, John. Thanks very much for your time.
Good morning, Michael. No problem at all.
Now, John, the St Andrews Links Trust, I endeavoured to educate myself on the website, but I gave up fairly quickly and thought I'd leave it to you to, as best you can, try and explain how that all works.
Well, okay, no problem. I mean, the Links Trust, we manage the golf courses set up in 1974. There was an Act of Parliament which was passed, which saw the formation of the Trust to manage the courses as public courses open to everybody. Obviously, golf has been played here at St Andrews for over 600 years, starting with the old course, which just evolved, and then coming on to the new and the Jubilee courses in the late 1800s, 1895, the new course was opened, 1897, the Jubilee course. We now have seven courses which we manage, and we manage them, as we said, with public courses, so open for everyone to play. I don't know if we will go into it anyway, but there's a popular misconception that the R&A actually run the golf courses, but they are one of five main clubs that actually play their competitions and play over the public links of St Andrews. So it's left to the Links Trust to try and manage the courses. But, you know, the five main clubs, R&A, the St Andrews Golf Club, the new club of St Andrews, their men's clubs, and St Andrews, St Regulus and St Rule are ladies' golf clubs that play in the town and over the courses.
So the Royal and Ancient Golf Club's a private club, but it doesn't own any course, it doesn't just play.
No, it doesn't own the course. No, I mean, it, you know, its commercial arm runs the Open Championship, and you know, the R&A is a members club which plays over the courses, and obviously it's got the responsibility of running the rules of the game throughout the world, with the exception of USA and Mexico.
Now, I understand it's the largest golf complex in Europe, is that right?
Yeah, it's the largest public golf complex in Europe. I mean, obviously with the seven, we've got six 18-hole courses and one 9-hole. We've got a large golf academy, golf practice centre. And so, obviously, in comparison to the world, or, you know, when you've got Mission Hills, which I think the last I heard was 12 golf courses. But certainly, we're very proud of the fact that it's public and we've got golf courses for all abilities.
And prior to being the director of golf there, John, you were with the European Tour previously?
Yeah. Well, when I graduated from university, I joined the British PGA for 6 years, then moved on to Wentworth to become the club administrator. And then in 98, just moved next door to the European Tour based at Wentworth as well. So just moved next door in Wentworth to work for the European Tour and worked for them for 9 years before coming here in 2007. So, yeah, no, I recall many good times. I worked with the rules side on the European Tour, so I remember refereeing at the Heineken at Royal Melbourne and down at Huntingdale.
Yes.
So, I've visited many times Australia, so had fantastic memories of that.
Are you coming out for the President's Cup?
No, unfortunately, now I'm back into the golf administration role. It's very much not so much tied to the desk here, but limited opportunities to go and enjoy the travelling as much, but made that decision, obviously. I had 9 years of travelling throughout the world, really. Administrating and doing the rules at tournaments throughout the world, and now, obviously, you're back to the home of golf, as it were, and it's really just trying to concentrate on my role here. Which as director of golf really looks after the golf services side, as it were, caddy, starters, golf academy, etc.
Can you tell us about the academy of caddies? How does that operate?
Well, we have a caddy program. We basically have about 160 licensed caddies. Caddies are independent contractors, so they're self-employed, and we do around about 22,000 caddy rounds a year here on the links. It's a busy program. You know, the old course, you know, has got such great qualities, and, you know, some of those qualities are that perhaps some of the tee lines are hidden, certainly going out they're hidden, and you need that experience of a local caddy to try and guide you through your 18 holes. So we have a full training program for these caddies, They've got to know the knowledge, not just of the course, but of the town of St Andrews.
So is it something a lot of guests take up? I guess more so internationally, I expect.
Yeah, I mean, we are roughly around about this time of year. You know, we're in our sort of, our high season is sort of middle of April to middle of October. And then again, even more concentrated sort of May to September. And, you know, as I said, we do 22,000 caddy rounds in a year over these links. So, I mean, we will probably have between 200 to 250 caddies out each day. So, yeah, and on the old course, you know, play starts at, in the summer months, play starts at 6:30 in the morning till 6:30 p.m. So, you know, we rely, we've got 160 great caddies who do a great job out there, and we rely on them to do up to two, if not three rounds a day. So one of the reasons we concentrate on pace of play, we make sure that, you know, we fully understand that, that golfers, a lot of golfers are here for a once-in-a-lifetime experience, so we don't want to rush them. We want to make sure that they enjoy it. They, you know, they take in the atmosphere of playing 17 up the last hole, up 18, you know. They take in the surroundings, the great atmosphere that St Andrews has to offer. So we'd never try to rush them. But, you know, our caddies will go out there and they'll do a round early in the morning and then we'll turn them around very quickly and they'll go out and do another round in the afternoon, if not two rounds.
Yeah, in summertime, you can tee off at 6:30 and still get a full 18 holes in during the height of summer in England.
Oh, yeah, no problem at all. I mean, I think our last visitor time is around about 5 o'clock, but, you know, we go up to 6:30 with local times, but if locals aren't there, then we allow visitors to play as well.
Sure.
But, yeah, no, in the height of summer, you know, in June, you know, we're talking 11 o'clock darkness.
I guess briefly touching on the history of St Andrews, I guess that's what we all are excited about, is, and the most well-known course, clearly, of the six that are there. I understand, doing some research, that the concept of 18 holes evolved from the old course, historically.
And
also double green.
Yeah, in the mid-1700s, you know, they originally there were 22 holes here, and there was only one hole in every green, and so you literally played 11 out and 11 back to the same hole. And in 1764, they decided that the first four holes and the last four holes were too short. So they merged four of those holes together, going out and coming back. So that reduced it from 22 down to 18 holes. So really the standard, that became the standard sort of number of holes throughout world golf, really. And that was 1764 here in St Andrews. And then the double greens, again in the 1850s, it's amazing how history repeats itself, but, you know, capacity was a problem, and there were commonly disputes because there used to be one hole in each green, so you, people would play out and play back to the same hole. So you would have disputes as to people coming in against people going out. And so in 1850s, they decided to cut a second hole in these greens, so that that's the, where the double greens evolved. It's just an unknown fact, really, is the fact that, you know, we have seven double greens, so 14 holes are played to a double green, and each of these double greens adds up to 18. So the 10th shares with the 8th, 7 with 11, 12 with 6, etc., etc. So we still have, say, 14 holes on the old course played to double greens to this day. The 1st, the 9th, the 17th, and the 18th are the only greens that you actually play to a single green.
And there's no issues with that? I mean, I haven't been there myself, but clearly on television, it's safe to say they look large enough, to say the least.
Yeah, no, they are. You know, the fifth green is almost 100 yards long. So, no, I mean, in the modern day of etiquette and politeness, you know, people will, certainly when tournament golf, you know, when the Open is here, you know, your modern day professional will think very carefully of his fellow competitors. So, you know, they will be very careful with, you know, playing shots and interfering with other groups on the golf course. Three course rangers out there on the old course each day to try and manage play and encourage people to play at an appropriate pace. But also they double up as making sure that they can marshal as best they can out there and try and manage play around these shared fairways and these crossover holes. But no, it's obviously a new, unique venue. It does pose us occasional slight problems just with pace of play and with lots of golfers in certain areas, but, you know, it's a fantastic problem to have, as it were.
No doubt. I mean, the pace of play, I'm sure it's an issue that's come with a lot of golf clubs to this day, no doubt.
Yeah. No, I mean, we don't have all the answers here. You know, we would never think or suggest that we did. You know, we publish this on the scorecards and recommend the pace of play. We have three course rangers out there. But as I said earlier, you know, you've got people here on a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We don't want to spoil that for them by hassling them around the golf course. I mean, we also have, you know, a unique problem in that, you know, we will have lots of photographs being taken, whether it's on the Swilcombe Bridge, whether it's on the 17th tee, whether it's in hell or shell bunkers. You know, if a golfer gets in there and he's got a caddy, then, you know, invariably there will be a number of photos going on as well. So, you know, it's trying to manage that and make sure that everyone enjoys the experience.
What's the Swilcombe Bridge, a bit of history about that. I mean, I expect surely you've got a photo of yourself on the bridge up on the wall, no doubt.
I don't. I mean, it's obviously a fantastically pictured bridge. We don't really know much about it. Well, I don't know much about it. I mean, we reckon it's been built sometime in the 18th century, mid-1700s, as it were. But apparently the harbour used to be at the far point of the Eden Estuary, and people used to walk into town because it was the ecclesiastical capital of Scotland, you know, so people would come by boat and traipse over the golf courses going up to the cathedral at the top of the town. So we think that it has been there for obviously centuries, and we're not...
Let me run this one past you.
Sure.
On the 18th hole, Granny Clark's Wind. I mean, what can you tell us about that?
Well, that's we don't know much about Granny Clark or who she was, but I mean, that's just really is the lifeboat shed apparently used to be on the south side of the first and 18th fairways, and so they used to pull the lifeboat across the wind whenever it was required to go out to sea. But it was adjusted to make it straighter in 1855, and then in 1823 it was tarred. But I mean, it's just another unique thing that we have at the old course, and it's great to see. You know, when Martin Keimer won the Dunhill Links Championship last year, you know, he hit it into the edge of the Granny Clark's Wind. You know, it's an integral part of the course from a rules point of view, so you just have to play off it. So sure. You know, he was hitting a little punch with his 8-iron or whatever, you know, off the tarmac, which is certainly unusual for most golfers watching a tournament. So it certainly just adds that more character. You know, if it's possible to get any more character than we have here at St Andrews, it's great to have that unique character.
I guess it's similar to the wall along the 17th hole, isn't it?
Yeah, the road on road hole and the wall. You know, when you've seen many pros over the years, you know, have to play either from up against the wall or off the road, yeah. So
is the Granny Clark's, is it still used for vehicle traffic or just there?
It is, yeah. It's a one-way sort of road that runs from town over to the West Sands, as we call it, towards the beach. So, yeah, it still is it's used daily for vehicle traffic, and obviously very popular as well for anyone who wishes to walk over to the beach. Very popular when the students are here. The students are on holiday at the moment, but, you know, during term time, you know, we frequently have lots of people wandering over Granny Clark's to get to the beach.
Now, look, this stumbled me when I read it on the internet, that the course is actually closed every Sunday. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, we are always closed on Sundays. We are open literally for about four events each year that have been approved for Sunday golf. So in a normal year, it would be those four Sundays only that golf is allowed. Again, I think it's religious reasons dating back centuries. You know, Tom Morris was apparently said that the golfers might not need a rest, but the course certainly did. So it's that still really applies. You know, it's a very big day for us maintenance wise. Guys get out there on a Sunday and do as much maintenance as they can. And it's open to the public. I mean, one of the things that you just would be staggered to see really is just the fact that it is a public facility, public golf course. So on a Sunday, people can just wander all over the course. You know, people not quite having picnics, but, you know, pushing prams, etc., all down the first and 18th fairways, and it'll be quite busy with just general people wandering around.
Mm. Do they sort of rope off the greens to stop traffic from...
Yeah, well, we rope off. We have an old course watch, as we call it. So there's a ranger that we have positioned by the road bunker on 17 just to try and make sure that people aren't you know, you're not really going to do much damage, but make sure that people aren't clambering up the face, et cetera, et cetera. People will be getting their photos taken, but just we have someone on hand just to make sure it's all done in an orderly fashion, which it always does done, no problem at all. And we take the flag off the 18th green and we put a temporary flag just in between the 18th green and the first tee so that when people take their photos, they can be taking the photo of the flag with the Army clubhouse behind it and they are slightly just off onto the approach. So that, cool. You know, from a wear and tear point of view, it makes a massive difference.
I must admit, if I was there with my kids, I'd probably be bolting to Hell's Bunker and get them to build sandcastles, and I think it would be a great photo opportunity.
Exactly.
So I wouldn't have been the first to do that. Oh, just on that, are all six courses closed on a Sunday or just the old?
No, just the old. Just the old. I think it really was about the wartime, the Second World War, that Eden was approved for opening. And I think when the war finished, they took a referendum, as it were, a survey in town, and they voted for the Eden to then be open all day on a Sunday. Well, I think it started out on a Sunday afternoon, and then it went to all day. Yeah, it's all other, our other six courses are all open on Sunday. It's just the old course that's closed. But, I mean, if you think the old course, we still do 45,000 rounds a year on the course with it being closed every Sunday, so 6 days a week. So it doesn't need a rest, and it's very important for it to get that rest.
Sure. How many groundskeeping staff employed, I guess, overall, the development?
We're around about 80. Over all the courses, including a number of seasonal staff that we take on, obviously, in the summer months. So, yeah, around about 80.
Are they all kept to the same similar standard or some better than others?
Yeah, no. I we would hope that we're all similar standard. We're not really in the... we can't really try and focus on certain events either. You know, we're hoping that they're all on a similar standard year-round. You know, we've got so many, whether it's for visitors or whether it's for local competitions or whatever, you know, we're hopeful that people find it in a very similar high standard right the way around from May through to October. And we're also very fortunate as well. We're a 12-month a year course. You know, we in our low season, we have mats. We have mats on our old course from November right the way through to the end of March, and that helps protect, you know, and in the low season when we've got no or less growth, you know, there's more damage takes place with divots, and it's less of an opportunity for that damage to be repaired. So we play off mats on the old between November and end of March, and on the other courses between November and the end of February, just to try and give them a rest. And that's just really on fairways, you know. So if your ball lands on the fairway, you play off a little mat, a little AstroTurf piece of that, which works really well. I mean, if you've got a dodgy short game like I have, you know, you've got an opportunity to place your ball in a little bit of AstroTurf from 40 yards out is a great benefit, I tell you.
Absolutely. Do you play much yourself, John?
No, not much. I used to play a lot of amateur golf, but not much these days.
So what's your best handicap? Come on.
Well, I was plus one at one point in my late student days before I started working in the game. And as you know, as soon as you start working in the game, your golfing ability tends to go downhill quite rapidly, I found anyway.
That's right. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
Now, do you know approximately the number of staff in total for the...
Yeah, we're around about 350, including all our seasonal staff at the height of the summer months. We now have a large retail operation as well, so we now have four shops. We've got five shops. We've now taken on the Tom Moritz shop as well, just to the right of the 18th green. So
does that relate? So that mean you've got three clubhouses in total when you say shops?
Yeah. We've got our Eden clubhouse, which I'm sitting in at the moment, which really processes and services golfers who play in the Eden, the Strathtyrum, the Balgold, and the Practice Centre. We have our Lynx Clubhouse, which was built in 1995, and that's just to the right of the second fairway on the old course. So that really services golfers who play in the old, the new, and the Jubilee. And then we've got our Castle Course Clubhouse as well.
What would be the cost, would you estimate, John, of maintaining all six courses just to bamboozle us with the figure?
Yeah, well, we have a turnover around about 15 million. You know, for the whole turnover. So I am not sure what the actual cost of, you know, it's difficult to apportion. I'm sure if we drill down into the accounts, our our director of finance could tell me that, but I'm sorry sure. I don't have that figure available for you. But, you know, we've got about the 15, last year we had a turnover of 15.6 million. Yeah. And, you know, and I think it's just important to pass on the message as well. I mean, any surpluses, we are a trust with charitable status. And any surpluses that we make go into the maintenance and preservation of all these golf courses.
Sure.
So, you know, if you're buying any shirts or any jumpers in the shops, you know, the swing ticket clearly states that you're contributing towards the preservation of the historic links of St.
Sure.
Andrews.
So hop on the website standrews.org.uk and start buying up.
Yeah, well, exactly. Good online facility now as well, yeah.
So what's in relation to the St. Andrews town, all the resident owners, they have a tie-in with the trust at all? Or?
We are obviously a public facility, and so the golf clubs play over the courses. Now, what we obviously do to manage the golf courses, we don't have members as such, but we have what we call ticket holders, so you can purchase a yearly ticket to play on the links. So under the Act of Parliament in 1974, certain rights are in place for residents of the town of St. Andrews. So if you are a permanent resident of the town, you are entitled to purchase a yearly ticket for play on all seven courses of the links.
Okay.
And that, at the moment, works out at £180.
Wow.
To play all your golf on all seven courses. Obviously, subject to availability, you go into the ballot to get onto the old course, or you can walk onto the new or whatever. But, you know, if you are a permanent resident, then, as I said, under the Act, you know, we have certain obligations to look after the people of the residents of St. Andrews, and that is that falls into that category.
And a hot ticket to heaven, of course.
Yeah, exactly. So we've obviously got the resident ticket. We've then got tickets for people who live in North East Fife and people who live out west North East Fife. And if you're members of a local golf club as well, then you've got certain benefits in those tickets. We do have, at the moment, our waiting lists are closed. And obviously, the opportunity to play on seven golf courses in great condition at reasonable rates has meant a lot of demand for these tickets, yearly tickets. Three different main categories of tickets. You know, your resident, your North East Fife, and then your out with North East Fife ticket holder.
And how many of those entitled ticket holders across those three categories would there be?
Well, you know, we've then got R&A members who've got tickets as well. I mean, you're talking between 5,000 and 6,000 ticket holders probably in total.
And I expect, what percentage of residents take that up out of interest?
It's a very difficult one to estimate, really. You know, we have a lot of interest. Certainly, if you're a golfer and you came to the town, then you'd be interested in taking it up. But,
sure.
You know.
How many residents or how many houses do you think there'd be in St. Andrews?
Well, there's talk about a population of about 14,000. But, you know, it does fluctuate with the student, you know, times of the year.
Have you found that the economic climate of the past few years has affected the operation at all that you can tell?
Yeah, well, we're very fortunate. We were certainly very
good. Being the home of golf's a big advantage to get past that, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, no, we've been very fortunate in that, you know, we found that we still had great demand for golf in 2009. 10 was obviously our open year. Traditionally, the year after the Open, we put great demand, and we've been lucky and that has followed through in 2011. But
just with the Royal and Ancient Clubhouse, can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, I guess there's a fairly bit of history involved, of course.
Yeah, well, we've got it's slightly separate there, because the Links Clubhouse I mentioned there in 1995 was built at that point to obviously service the golfers. Prior to 1995, you know, golfers used to come to town and we used to change shoes in the car park or used to change in the Russox Hotel, etc. There was limited facilities. So in 1995, we got planning permission to improve the facilities for visiting golfers, and that's when the Links Clubhouse was built. The five main clubs that I talked about earlier all have clubhouses around about the 1st and 18th. So probably the most commonly known is the R&A Clubhouse, which was built, I think, in 1854, and that's the one that sits right behind the first tee in the old course. Sure. St Andrew's Club is just the right of 18, St Regulus, St Rule, right of 18. Mm-hmm. So that whole historic home end, as we call it, is littered with the clubhouses for these famous golf clubs.
Are they all open to the public to access those?
No, they're all private members' clubs, and so they are limited access. I think the R&A opens its doors to the public on St Andrew's Day every year, which is 30th of November.
What can you tell? What secrets lie behind the grand doors of the Royal and Ancient Clubhouse, John, that you can share with us?
Well, not really that much, really. I mean, it's a fantastic facility, you know, full of history, trophy room and, you know, big room, etc. And they open the doors. Whether it's the Open Championship, they also used the R&A clubhouse when the Women's British Open was here in 2007. All the competitors used that clubhouse. So it certainly, you know, it's a private members club, but they certainly are very hospitable in extending the facilities to visiting golfers in these big championships.
Sure. And if there's Australians travelling over looking for the game, do you suggest they book online if they're handicapped golfers, or do they take the risk and go in the ballot?
I think the ballot is, we're changing the ballot to 2 days ahead in January of next year. But the ballot's a great opportunity. I mean, the ballot gives golfers who are in the area the opportunity to get onto the old course. I mean, there's a number of different ways of trying to secure a time in the old course. I mean, basically, the first Wednesday in September at 10 a.m. UK time, we open up for our advanced reservations. So that's groups of eight or less. Minimum two, but you can single golfers can apply as well, sorry, but who wish to apply for a time the following year. So we get inundated. We're around about 2,000 applications in the first half an hour in September 2010. But that's where we issue all our times for 2012, first Wednesday in September this year, 10 a.m. And there's more information on standrews.org.uk and how to book about that. And you basically email your form, you apply, and you follow the rules as laid out there. So that's an option, you know, for golfers who know well in advance what their plans are and when they're trying to come over for the year. So you give a couple of options, and hopefully there's availability there. Second option is, you know, there's lots of tour operators who work in and throughout Scotland, really, and throughout Fife and St Andrews, who will also have various times available on the old course. And the final route really is just the ballot. And as I said, there are opportunities daily in the ballot. Obviously, there's no golf on Sunday, but every other day, as long as there's not a major club competition or a major event on, there will be certain times in the ballot. And the only piece of advice I could give is that, you know, on a Thursday and a Saturday, we've got double the amount of ballot times. So if you are planning on coming over and spending a few days in St Andrews, then, you know, if you can build in a Thursday or a Saturday to your itinerary, then that will give you double the chance of obtaining a time in the ballot. I'm just going to say the ballot really just works on supply and demand. Really. The number of times that are there, you know, we frequently get asked, oh, what's the chances? You know, it really just depends. If there are, you know, hundreds of people in town 1 week, then the chances in the ballot are slightly less because you'll have hundreds of people applying for times. There might be other weeks in the year where there are a lot less visitors. And so, you know, you've got a great chance.
What do you think the most common surprise is, John, when people arrive and experience St Andrews when they're visiting?
I just think it's just the fact that you're playing 18 right into town. You know, you're coming out of the shops alongside the 18th green, the whole buzz of the area. You've got people wandering around, whether it's wandering down from town into in and around the first tee, you know, on their way to the beach. You know, it's just the fact that it's so open to the public. You know, there's a tremendous atmosphere, tremendous buzz around about the 18th green, first tee. There'll always be, you know, if you tee off in the first, there'll always be people around, you know, or you pull out in the 18th green. There's always people, just general day trippers to St Andrews or whoever, who just want to come and sort of watch some golf. So it's just amazing how much atmosphere there is always around about that area.
And is there, I mean, I might have stolen your fame as far as an interesting fact that most people wouldn't be aware of about the old course or I guess the clubhouse itself.
Well, I think, you know, I mentioned the fact that we're always closed on Sundays. I think, you know, that people are amazed that, you know, that still goes on. But, you know, that will continue to go. There's certainly never any plans for that not to happen. It's very important. Another interesting fact, really, was that it used to be played in reverse, really, in the late 1800s. You know, they used to play from the first to the 17th green, and from the second tee, you know, and then from the 18th tee to the 16th green. So they used to play the old course in reverse.
Okay.
So when you go out there and you look at some bunkers on the course, you think, oh, that bunker's not really in play, or I can't see that bunker. When you actually stand on the green and look towards the green behind you, then some of these bunkers become a lot more visible. And you can just then imagine, you can then just imagine how they played in their own days. They used to alternate. They used to go sometimes in reverse, and then they would go back in the traditional route now that we have.
Sure.
But that was certainly the case. Up until around about 3 years ago, we used to have a weekend at the start of April where we used to have old course in reverse weekend, as it were. So we'd go back into playing in that that route. And, you know, it was popular. I think we ran it for about 10 years. We ran that sort of weekend where back to the... If you imagine trying to hit it to the 16th green off the 18th tee, you know, so these railway sheds, you know, these railway sheds on the corner you hit over in 17, you know, you're hitting in there with your second shot trying to go to that 16th green. So, tremendous challenge.
Sure. Just on the British Open, St. Andrews has held the British Open 28 times, I understand.
Yep, that's right.
And how did that go? It was obviously held there last year. What's your involvement specifically with that event?
Well, to be honest, I mean, we provide the facilities. The green staff work very closely with RMA in preparing the golf course. And really, they start thinking about, you know, with the consultation with RMA, they start thinking, you know, straight after the Open as to what, if any improvements are required the next time it visits here. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, we get involved in the marshalling and we get involved in the staging of the event. But the R&A, we really hand it over to the R&A. We work closely with the R&A, but they just do a great job. They're obviously used to staging the event, and they've done it, obviously, many times here at St Andrews. They know how things work, so we just really hand over our facilities and try and make sure that we help them as much as we can to ensure the smooth running of the event, really.
Sure. Were you pleased to see Darren Clark get across the line a few weeks
ago? Excellent result, yeah. No, he is a great exponent of links golf and certainly a very deserved winner of the championship. So, no, fantastic to see.
John, do you know much history about the claret, the elusive claret jug?
Not really. Just looking into it slightly, you know, it was first played for in 1873 because young Tom Wallace, it used to be a championship belt. When the Open started, there was a championship belt that was presented, and when you won it three times, you got to keep the belt. So Tom Morris, young Tom Morris, won it for a third time in 1871, so he got to keep that belt, so they had to have a replacement trophy, and that replacement turned out to be the claret jug. Wasn't done in time for the 1872 event, but then was first presented in 1873, but the winner in 1872, which I think was young Tom Morris, with the first name to go back onto that jug. I don't know the reasons of why it was a claret jug. I can imagine certain things, but I don't know the reasons for that. But that is just looking into the history. I mean, the R&A have got a fantastic golf museum, which is just opposite their clubhouse in St Andrews.
I saw Darren Clark interviewed after his win with his pint of Guinness on the table in front of the meeting. No doubt what his intentions were with the claret jug, one would think.
Oh, no, I think he enjoyed the celebration. I think the celebration went on for a day or two. So, yeah, good on him anyway. No, great for him to do that.
You're heavily involved with the rules recently. I'm sure there's a lot of interesting situations you come across during that time. Can you maybe share a few of those with us, being a rules official that you came across?
Yeah, no, as I said, I travelled extensively. I did have a couple of run-ins, as it were. I think Sergio Garcia once managed to slip in the early days of his professional career. He played in the World Match, but I happened to be refereeing the match between him and Goosen, and he slipped, took off his shoe and threw it at an advertising board. Which once he picked it up, he was handed the shoe back, and rather than pick up, he kicked it, which went hurtling through the air and just missed my head, as it were. So I think he got a little fine for that, but that was that was well covered in the press nationally at that point. Just the fact that you know, it wasn't that close, and it was just the couple of spikes into the back of my head, which probably was in my head, so I'm good, actually. But, no, I mean, I had great times. I refereed, you know, just one Open Championship when I worked for the British PGA, but I refereed some Ryder Cup matches as well when I worked for the Tour, so they were always nerve-wracking prior to actually getting started. And once you got started, they were fantastic memories.
Which player did you enjoy watching the most during that time?
You know, in that 1993 Open, I refereed Payne Stewart, and he shot 63 in the final round. And again, really, one of the matches in the 2006 Ryder Cup, the match I did that year was Tiger Woods, and again, he made it look fantastically easy as well. You see so many great golfers, really. It really is a pleasure to be out there. I mean, they all strike the ball so superbly well, you know, at all levels on the tour, really, even challenge to.
Sure, and when you're refereeing those big matches, the role is to follow that group through their whole round, isn't it? So you're getting it.
And these bigger events, and the Open Championship, you have a walking referee with each game, and you will have that in the Ryder Cup as well. When you do a normal tour event, we'll maybe have six or seven referees out in the course, so they will be positioned strategically to try and cover as many groups in that area. You might well look after three or four holes in an area. Slightly more nerve-wracking when you're called to a certain area and you're thinking, who could be in that area? You know, because when you're actually walking with a match and you can see someone hit it into a grandstand, or you can see someone hit it into an area that you know is marked as GUR, then, you know, it is a lot more straightforward than if you come blind to a situation. You're driving a buggy, trying to get through the crowds, and, you know, 99 times out of 100, when you get there, it's a very straightforward ruling.
And what player would concern you the most when you're turning up to a situation and you go, oh no, what's this fella going to come up with? Is there someone that would concern you the most, I guess?
No, I mean, I think you would always just have, your, you know, with your massive galleries and your TV coverage, etc., you know, you were always slightly, as I said there, when you're not knowing what the position is, you know, you would always maybe look at your draw sheet in the days of the late 90s and early 2000s, if Seve was out there or Lamonti or something like that, and, you know, you were getting called to a rural situation. As I said, 99 times out of 100, it was quite straightforward and it was easily rectified.
In relation to the future of the St Andrews Links Trust, is there any changes on the forefront moving forward, or where to from here for the Trust?
No, I think obviously the Castle opened in 2008, that's our seventh course, so, you know, there's no plans for any new course or anything like that, so, I mean, it's really just trying to make sure that we continue to provide as good service as we can, make sure the golf course is in good condition, and make sure that, you know, we still encourage or continue to encourage, you know, visits from throughout the world from all these keen golfers. Relying heavily on visiting golfers, and quite rightly, we want to get them around the golf courses and we want them to enjoy the facilities. But, you know, we also need to look at other areas as well that we can concentrate on as far as our revenue stream is concerned.
Sure.
That doesn't rely on, you know, after, you know, the volcanic ash, etc. That always brings home to you, you know, that what happens if, what happens if, you know, golfers are not able to travel for particular reasons, you know.
Yeah.
You know, we've also obviously got to try and ensure that we, not so much diversify, but we've got other opportunities out there that we're not relying 100% on visiting golfers playing on golf.
Absolutely. I'm sure that's the challenge of a lot of golf clubs today. I mean, St Andrews in a different situation, but a lot of clubs be grappling with, you know, people are challenged with time and money out there. So, yeah, it's a big challenge.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy at all. Retaining members, you know, as you say, the time that game of golf takes. So there are developments out there, you know, with power play and with nine hole courses and just shorter time span for golf as well. And it's difficult for golf clubs to retain members and to attract new members. There are a lot of golf courses out there that, you know, people do have a lot of pressure on their time, you know, and
how do you think those initiatives will pan out? Like you say, there's, I think Conor Montgomery had a system of having two flag positions on nine holes, and in Stableford there would be a tougher flag that would get you double points, for example, and there's other models. Do you think they'll be retained and become popular, or is there...
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, hopefully, I mean, it's good to see initiatives like that trying to get people interested in the game. And as I said, there is a tremendous pressure on people's time these days, you know, family-wise, to go for a game of golf and take maybe 3.5-4 hours. You know, you're maybe away for 4 to 5 hours. So it's great to see initiatives out there to try and reduce that time taken to play the game. And so hopefully they're all successful and, you know, there are other initiatives out there. I mean, I think it relates. I think when I hear people discussing it, it's similar to the sort of 2020 initiative in cricket, etc.
Sure.
So, you know, it's great to see other possibilities out there. You know, you never know. It might become more popular than the traditional 18-hole game of golf in years to come, in decades to come. We never can tell. It's good to see people actually going out there and putting the ideas down there and testing the market, and hopefully they're successful.
John, I know you're busy. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Not at all, Michael. Not at all. Yeah. It's a pleasure. Yeah.